happy. It became almost a civic duty for her to look as though she were having a good time. People remarked about her happiness as often as they commented on the possibility of rain or the barometric pressure. Many times she felt as closely watched as a prisoner on parole for good behavior. She did not mind being noticed, but resented being studied. The town made her far more aware of being motherless than Rome ever had. Wherever she turned, Leah was bumping into Shiloh's past. Suddenly, her mother seemed everywhere, yet for Leah, she remained elusive, untouchable in both her consciousness and life. The more Leah learned about her mother, the less she was certain she knew anything about Shiloh at all. In synagogue one Saturday, Elsie Rosengarten, an elderly Jewish woman who had taught Shiloh in the second grade, burst into tears when she was introduced to Leah. I explained later, holding my child's hand. "It shocks people because you look so much like your mother."
"I look something like you, too."
"Well, not enough for anyone to notice," I said, catching a sideways glimpse of Leah, wondering if the beauty of their children humbled all parents. Since our return, there was rarely a night when I didn't get up at 3 a.m. to make sure Leah was still breathing.
"Do people think I'm going to do something to myself just because Mama did?" Leah said. "Is that why they're looking at me?"
"No, not at all," I said.
"It is so," she said. "You're just protecting me."
"No, I'm not. People can't believe I could raise a girl all by myself who'd seem so normal and well-adjusted," I explained. "Your mother was all over you when you were a baby, nuts for you. She wouldn't let me or anyone else near you for the first year. She made it seem as though it was a great sacrifice to let me change your diaper."
"How disgusting," Leah said.
"Well, you'd think so," I said. "But it's nice when it's your kid, and it's part of the job to be done. I liked changing your diaper."
"You're worried about your mother dying, aren't you?" Leah said, putting her cheek on my forearm. "I can tell."
For a moment I hesitated, but I could hear the call for intimacy in her voice, the desire for me to let her enter those grottos where I tended my own fear of my mother's illness. "You don't know what a bad son I've been to her, Leah," I said. "You don't know the things I've said to her, unforgivable things. I've looked at her with pure hate in my eyes so many times. I never understood her, and I punished her for that ignorance. I'm afraid she's going to die before I'm ever able to apologize enough times."
"She knows you love her, Daddy," Leah said. "I heard her tell Dr. Peyton the other night that she doesn't know any other son in the world who would move all the way from Italy just to be with his mama when she needed him."
"Did you make that up?"
"She said something like that," Leah said. "That's what she meant, anyhow."
Early that night, we walked on the beach again and felt the sea underfoot as we waded through the reflections of the evening star endlessly repeating itself in the pools created by the withdrawing tide. The coming of summer was announcing itself as the water temperature grew warmer every day. The cells of each wave began to light up with the approach of June, and each field on the way to town was covered with tomato vines and green fruit pulling sunlight out of the air. The days were already beginning to be hot long before the sea got the word. An ocean was a hard thing to warm up, but Leah and I felt it happening as we splashed along the beach waiting for the moon to rise. A mist rose off the cooling sand, and gulls flew north above us in the last light. A gull cried, and it always made me think of heartbreak and a solitude that had no name. I hoped my own loneliness was not contagious, and that it would not pass through my bloodstream and enter the pale wrist of my daughter. I loved southern nights like these, and I wished I were a brighter, less brooding figure as we walked hand in hand along the beach, and I steered her beneath the great sisterhood of stars, unfurling in the night sky. For an hour, we walked along the shore until the night had taken hold completely as we started back toward Lucy's house. The stars were brilliant now, and the air smelled of sargassum, mollusks, and pine. Up ahead, we heard a sudden commotion. The moon threw off a reluctant, crescent-shaped light, and in it, Leah spotted the huge turtle ahead of us, and let out a cry of distress when she saw a young man jump on the loggerhead's broad-backed shell and begin slapping against the turtle's shell and front flippers, screaming like a buckaroo. We ran forward. "Get off the turtle, son," I said, trying not to lose my temper.
"Fuck you, mister," the boy spat out, and then I saw that he was showing off for his girlfriend.
"Please get off the turtle, son," I said. "That's about as nice as I can say it, kid."
"Maybe you don't hear too well," the college-age boy said. "Fuck you!"
I grabbed the boy's shirt, and he somersaulted backward off the turtle. He was older and larger than I had first judged, and he rose up, ready to fight. "Relax. This is a female loggerhead who's coming ashore to lay her eggs," I said.
"I hope you got a good lawyer, asshole," the boy said, "because there's a big lawsuit in all this."
"Daddy, she's going back to the ocean," Leah cried out.
The loggerhead had slanted off to the right and was in the midst of a great, heavy turn, navigating her ponderous way back to the water. The boy tried to cut her off, but stepped aside when I warned, "Her jaws can take your leg off, son. She can kill a full-grown shark with those jaws." The boy skittered out of the way as the great beast rushed forward, hissing, her breath rank and fish-like, polluting the air with an otherworldly smell. As soon as she reached deep enough water to displace her enormous weight, she transformed herself into something swift and angelic, and disappeared like a seabird into the enfolding sea.
"You let it get away!" the boy shouted.
"What were you going to do with it, kid?" I asked. "Paint its back and sell it to a 5 and dime?
"I was going to cut its throat."
I had not noticed the approach of a flashlight coming down the beach, but Leah had, and was already running toward the approaching figure. The next thing I knew, the young man held up his knife threateningly close to my face. "Loggerheads are on the endangered species list. It's a crime to interfere with their nesting," I said.
"Put the knife down, Augie," the girlfriend pleaded. "I've been fishing and hunting my whole life, partner," Augie said, "and my father always told me how good turtle steaks tasted, cooked over a driftwood fire."
"Your dad is an old-timer," I said. "That could get you jail time now. There's easier ways to eat seafood."
"Can I see the bill of sale where it says you own this beach, asshole?" Augie said.
"I used to swagger the same way when I was your age," I said, "but I didn't used to cuss. That's what MTV does to your sorry generation, don't you think?"
"Who climbed on the turtle's back?"
I heard my mother say, as the flashlight blinded Augie, who turned his head away.
"I did," Augie said. "I rode it for about 10 yards before this jerk-off knocked me off it."
"What's the knife for, son?" Lucy demanded.
"This guy attacked me," Augie said. "It's for self-defense."
The flashlight cracked down on the boy's wrist bone, and the knife fell to the sand. I picked it up, walked to the water's edge where the surf was breaking cleanly, and hurled the knife as far as I could out to sea.
"That knife's private property," Augie said, massaging his wrist.
"It still is," I said.
"My mother will report you to the cops," he said, walking back toward the line of houses, glowing with electric light.
"Who are your people?" Lucy asked. "Who do you belong to?"
"I'm a Jeter. My grandfather's Leonard Jeter."
"Well, tell Len I said hi. I'm Lucy Pitts," she said. "Keep off the turtles, son. We want them to put their eggs in the sand."
"I don't see you wearing no badge, lady."
"Shut up, Augie,"
his girlfriend said, as they disappeared out of the flashlight beam and into the paler light of houses.
"What'll the turtle do now?" Leah asked her grandmother.
"Well, she might just dump her eggs in the ocean, darling girl," my mother responded, directing a beam of light out toward the waves. "But the urge is pretty strong for her to put them in the sand. Maybe she'll wait us out and come in when there's not a soul on the beach."
"Especially Augie," Leah said.
"Oh, he's a Jeter," Lucy said. "His people are nothing but trash."
"Mother, please," I said.
"I'm just stating the facts," she said. "The whole family's got dirty fingernails. It runs with them like freckles."
"Daddy doesn't like people to put labels on other people, Grandma," Leah explained.
"He doesn't," Lucy said. "You can call a loggerhead a two-headed chicken, but that don't make it so. Same as a Jeter. You can dress that boy up in a tux, teach him the manners of a queen, and you still ain't got no Huguenot. Call a Jeter Rockefeller, and you still got a Jeter striding up your backyard. Right, Jack?"
"Shut up, Mama," I said. "I'm trying to raise her to think differently."
Lucy laughed and said, "Too bad, son. You brought her south. That's the way the South thinks, and she might as well get used to local custom."
The next morning, Leah woke me before sunrise, telling me to hurry. She had fixed me a cup of coffee to take to the beach for the morning patrol. We rode our bicycles to Lucy's house and parked them near the outdoor shower before removing our docksiders and joining Lucy, who was already on the beach. Lucy handed Leah 3 seashells, which she had gathered along the tide line.
"Those are perfect for your collection. We'll fill up a jar of them and make you a lamp to take back to Rome,"
Lucy instructed, placing 3 lady slippers into Leah's hand. Leah admired them, then put them carefully into my pocket, and warned me not to forget they were there.
"Did the mother turtle come back?" Leah asked.
"It's your job to find out," Lucy said. "You and your father are responsible for this next mile of beach. I'm responsible for the whole program."
"We're the first people out," Leah said, surveying the island from north to south.
A squadron of brown pelicans flew overhead, their shape and wingspan so effortless in the morning air that their appearance seemed a quiet psalm in praise of flight itself. They passed over us like shadows stolen from the souls of other shadows.
"Let's go swimming," I suggested.
But Leah shook her head.
"Not before we check the beach for loggerheads."
"I trust Leah with this job," Lucy said. "I don't trust you, Jack."
A few minutes wouldn't make any difference. For 300 yards, we walked in the wet sand, our footprints of different size, but related in shape and with precisely the same arch. Leah kept her eyes on the ground ahead of her, and she screamed when she saw the heavy markings of the loggerhead cutting a swath through the sand ahead of us.
"She came back!" Leah shouted. "She came back!"
Leah followed the deep cut the flippers had made when the turtle had returned from the sea. Lucy and I held back, letting Leah survey the scene where the tracks ended and the turtle had dug her nest. I was carrying the bucket and the long silver probe, which was a 9-iron with its club face broken off during a match. Leah took the damaged club and approached the mound the loggerhead had thumped down like tobacco in a pipe before she had returned to the Atlantic.
"She lays her eggs while facing the sea. Study her shape. The turtle fills in the hole with the same hind flippers she digs with," my mother said.
Leah probed the sand, as my mother had taught her to during a training season that had gone on for over 2 months. Leaning on the ruined club, she stuck it into the sand and looked up at Lucy when it did not give. Pulling it out, Leah tried another spot in the great round indentation where the turtle's shape was imprinted. With quick, sound thrusts, she kept stabbing into the well-packed sand until she hit a spot where the shank of the golf club sank. Leah knelt down and probed the sand cautiously with her index finger.
"It's here, Grandma," she cried out. "It feels like flour that's been sifted. The rest of the sand is hard-packed."
"That mother turtle fooled a lot of raccoons," Lucy said, "but she didn't fool Leah McCall 1 minute."
"Should I dig them up?" Leah said, looking up at her grandmother.
"We're taking them all up this year," Lucy said. "We're going to rebury them up by my house where it's safe."
"What does the South Carolina Wildlife Department say about that?" I asked.
"They don't like it worth a damn," Lucy admitted. "Dig, Leah, dig, darling."
For several minutes, I watched as Leah lifted handfuls of sand from a carefully crafted hourglass-shaped hole. Her eyes were fiercely concentrated on the job as she went deeper and deeper, relying totally on her sense of touch, letting her hand follow the soft and given sand. Then she recoiled and froze.
"Something's there," Leah said.
"Lift it carefully," Lucy said. "Everything you bring out is precious."
Leah's arm moved slowly, bringing up a round, white egg, slightly larger than a baby's fist. It was ivory-colored and leather-soft. It was a capable-looking egg. It looked big enough to hatch ospreys or vultures, but not quite big enough to create something so beastly and magnificent as a loggerhead.
"Place the egg in the bucket carefully, Leah," Lucy said. "Make sure the egg is facing the exact same direction as when you took it out of the nest. Nature's got her reason for everything. Put some sand into the bottom of the bucket first. That's it."
Time after time, Leah reached into the darkness up to her shoulder and brought up from the nest a single egg like a jewel. Her movements were all reverential. Never did she hurry in her excitement, and the introduction of each egg seemed like part of some elaborate dance of the seasons.
48, 49, 50,
Leah counted as she placed them one on top of the other, and Lucy made notations in a small notebook.
"Look, the turtle tried to climb over these rocks and didn't make it," Lucy said, pointing to tracks that led up to the large granite boulders that the owners had imported for erosion control. Sand was a preeminent force in the Low Country, and no rocks were indigenous to the area.
"Our houses on the beach kill more loggerheads than ghost crabs or raccoons ever thought about killing. They should never have allowed houses to be built in front of the sand dunes."
71, 72, 73, Leah kept counting.
"Was this a good place to nest?" I asked.
"A good spring tide would have flooded this hole for sure," Lucy said. "This nest didn't have a chance. But you can't blame the loggerhead. What can she do about those damn rocks? She'd need a grappling hook and a long rope to get over them. Then how would the babies get back to the sea? The whole thing's a bad business."
Carefully, Lucy recorded the location of the nest, the day and time of its discovery, the number of eggs laid, and the approximate time the turtle had come ashore to hollow out her nest and lay her eggs. Leah placed 122 eggs in the bucket, then carefully filled the hole back up and packed it down neatly with her feet.
"Now let's get these babies to a safe place," Lucy announced, handing the heavy bucket to me.
Leah walked ahead of us at a quick pace, taking the bucket to the area my mother had staked out for the birthing ground of this year's crop of loggerheads. My mother stopped to collect a row of clam shells that had washed up the night before. They were as prettily strewn as candy. When I turned back to the business at hand, I saw Leah being approached by a uniformed woman.
"Who's that?" I asked, "up by your house?"
Lucy groaned and said,
"Trouble with a master's degree. Let me do the talking. She gets confused when someone's kind to her."
The young woman was uniformed and pretty, and was talking to Leah in quick, animated conversation about the gathering of turtle eggs. Leah gestured toward them, and then bent to the sand to demonstrate how she had found and procured the pail of eggs I was carrying.
"I've always loathed women named Jane," Lucy said, preparing for battle. "It predisposes them toward mischief and indigestion."
"You conducted a study?"
"A lifetime of observation, son," she whispered,
but her voice turned voluble and cheerful as they approached the straight-backed woman.
"Hello, Jane. I was just telling my son what a pretty name you've got. Jack, meet Jane Hartley. You've already met my granddaughter, Leah."
"You allowed her to dig up a whole nest of loggerheads?" Jane said, in a voice official and distant. She was wearing the uniform of the South Carolina Wildlife Department.
"I bet you didn't tell Leah it was against state law, and that you spent a day in jail last summer for doing the same thing."
"That's not true, is it, Grandma?" Leah said.
"It's technically true," Lucy admitted, "but nothing is so unconvincing as mere technical truth. Hand me the shovel, Jack. I'm going to dig a fresh hole."
"I'm confiscating these eggs," Jane said, getting up and taking a step toward me. But Lucy moved between us with resolve and intent.
"This year I'm not losing one egg to the stupidity of you idiots in the wildlife department. Not one," said Lucy.
"You love playing God, don't you, Lucy?" Jane said.
"For a long time," Lucy said, flipping through her salt-splashed notebook, "I played it by the book. Admit it, Jane, I didn't touch one turtle's nest. I followed all the directives of your department to the letter. Nature knows best," Jane Hartley and the State Wildlife Department said. "Let the eggs lie where the mother buries them. Let nature take its course," you ordered. "Nature's cruel, but nature has its reasons."
"Those reasons still apply," Jane said. "We find it more logical to follow God's way of doing things than Lucy's way."
"My way gets a hell of a lot more baby loggerheads in the water than God's way, and this notebook proves it," Lucy said, waving her notebook over her head like a weapon.
"My grandma loves the turtles," Leah said.
"She does love the turtles," Jane agreed. "It's the law she doesn't give a damn about."
"My son is a world-renowned writer and author of cookbooks," said Lucy, with egregious ill-timing. "He'll remember every slanderous word you utter. He's got a mind like a steel trap."
"You are impervious to my mother's charms, Officer Hartley," I said.
"Your mother's a pain in the ass, Mr. McCall," the woman stated. "My job is difficult enough without having to fight with someone who claims to be on the side of ecology."
"Listen to what her side did, Jack and Leah.
They sent out a memorandum to all the turtle projects on the South Carolina coast. There's one on every island from here to the North Carolina coast. Every island's having erosion problems. Half the nesting habitat of the loggerheads have been destroyed in the past 10 years. Everybody in the program's worried sick. Those geniuses put out a new set of rules that say we can't touch an egg or a nest once the turtle is laid. We can't protect a nest, move a nest, guard a nest, nothing. They've all got nice offices in Columbia. They're all drawing big salaries. They're all feeding off the lifeblood of taxpayers like me.
Someone's got to pay for my Maserati, Jane deadpanned to me.
Could we compromise? I suggested. We've already gone a little far, according to the law.
If I had my way, you'd get a year in jail for each egg in that bucket, she said briskly, but was startled when Leah began screaming.
We could go to jail for 122 years, Daddy, Leah said, running to my side and encircling my waist with her arms. Just for helping Grandma.
I knew being exposed to that woman would come to no good, I said.
Relax, Leah. We're not going to jail.
Lucy might this time, Jane said. Looks like I caught you red-handed.
Lucy reached out and took the bucket out of my hand, then said,
I've tried to be reasonable with you people, I really have. You don't live with the problem every day, Jane. It's not fair and it's not right, and it's sure as hell not good for the survival of these turtles.
If man keeps interfering with the nests, then these turtles have no chance of surviving, Jane countered.
It's a theory, Jane, something you write down on a piece of paper, something that looks good and sounds good and reads pretty, but it doesn't work.
It's worked for millions of years, Lucy. It's proven effective since the age of dinosaurs.
Listen, Jack and Leah, listen to what happened. We did what Jane here said. Down to the letter, we followed her directions. Because they had statistics and charts and their damn degrees. Because they had badges and guns and the weight of the law behind them. Tell Leah what happened, Jane. Tell the child how well your theories worked.
Our theories worked perfectly, the woman said, tightening her gun belt. Nature allowed a certain number of nests to yield a certain number of loggerheads. Some nests were destroyed by predators. That has to be expected.
Sounds reasonable, Mother, I said. Son, I acknowledge your expertise when it comes to ziti or pepperoni pizza, but you're in your rookie year with the turtle ladies, Lucy said, staring hard at Jane Hartley and being stared at in return.
Lucy considers herself above the laws of nature, Jane said.
The laws of nature are now killing me, Jane, Lucy shot back. I'm painfully aware how subject I am to those laws. You won't be having this argument with me next year, but I pray to God one of the other turtle ladies will take my place.
Give me those eggs, Lucy.
No, Lucy said. I most certainly will not. What would you do with the eggs?
Take them back to my office, Jane answered. Photograph them for evidence, examine them for damage, then bring them back to the island and rebury them as close to the original nest inside as possible.
We need to get these eggs in the ground right this minute, said Lucy, walking over and picking up a shovel that she had leaned against the supports of her deck. I'm moving all turtle nests on this island to the dry sand right in front of my house, Jane. That way I can protect them myself, because they won't be but 20 yards away from the pillow where I'm sleeping.
And that way you get to break the law every time a turtle comes up on this beach.
What happened to the nests last year? I asked.
Nothing happened to them, Jane said.
Only 20% of them produced any hatching turtles at all, Lucy said, starting to dig her hole.
The laws of nature prevailed, said Jane, addressing herself to me now. Lucy's made the mistake of personalizing her relationship to all those eggs and loggerheads.
Last year there were 120 nests, Lucy countered, but the erosion on the south side of the beach was terrible. A lot of beachfront was lost due to a bad nor'easter in February. Everybody on the beach started putting loads of granite in front of their houses. Bulldozers moved tons of sand over the rocks. The place crawled with dump trucks. When the turtles came in that May, it was like someone had built the Great Wall of China over their nesting grounds. Two of them laid their eggs in a sandbar 20 yards out into the ocean. That's how desperate they were. We moved those nests.
Without our permission, Jane said.
Yes, but you refused permission to move any of the nests laid at the foot of the rocks for 2 miles along the south beach, Lucy said, attacking the sand with her shovel. The spring tides were extraordinary last year.
the whole ocean seemed to rise up and try to reach out toward dry land. Some tides covered the tops of the marsh grass. 56 nests were wiped out by those tides. That's a possible 6,000 turtles who didn't make it to the water because Jane and her colleagues are stupid.
We made a mistake, Lucy. We admitted it. They wouldn't let me lay wire fencing to protect the nests from raccoons and dogs. Lost 27 more nests that way. The goddamn coons are common as roaches on this island because they love to tip over garbage cans of fat tourists from Ohio. I found 17 coons fighting and squalling over a nest of turtle eggs that they'd spread up and down the beach.
We're on the same side in this battle, Jane said. You've never understood that, Lucy.
Then help me teach my granddaughter how to dig a turtle hole that'll make these eggs feel like Mama dug it.
I want you to know, Mr. McCall, that your mother was like this before she got sick, Jane said, throwing up her hands in exasperation.
I know, I said. She raised me.
Lucy handled the shovel with economy and expertise, and as she lifted the sand out in small spadefuls, a rounded hole that reproduced the hourglass-shaped nest excavated by the back flippers of the loggerhead began to emerge. It was a lovely, strange sort of mimicry, and it made me realize the long, patient hours of observation that she had spent studying the habits of those ungainly turtles.
"Come here, child," Lucy said to Leah. "Round it out on both sides now. Pretend you're the mother and you want to dig the loveliest and safest nest in the world for your babies. The shovel is your back flipper, and you want your eggs to drop in a beautiful round room where the only sound they'll hear is the surf."
"Like this?" Leah said, concentrating hard, as she slid the blade of the shovel along the side of the hole and brought up barely more than 1/2 pound of sand.
"Perfect. Around that other side off. You think it's deep enough, Jane?"
Jane came over and inspected the hole. She went down on her knees and put her arm into the hole, almost up to the shoulder.
"I'd go another 6 inches," she said, and Lucy nodded in agreement.
Leah dug out another 6 inches of sand and placed it on the small dune that rose up on one side of the nest.
"What if it's not just right, Grandma? What'll happen?"
"Probably nothing, but since we're flying blind here, we might as well be as careful as we can. We've got 122 baby turtles counting on us to get it right."
"See what I mean about being too personal?" Jane said.
"Now comes the fun part," Lucy said, instructing Leah with unusual patience.
"I think this is the greatest Easter egg hunt in the world. We find the eggs, dig them up, walk them to a safe place, and now we get to bury them again."
"You do it, Grandma," Leah asked. "I'll watch the first time."
"No, I want this whole nest to be yours. You'll help me watch over this one and all the rest. But I want you to put each one of those eggs down in the hole. So when they hatch, I'll have you dig them up, and they'll know your smell."
"It doesn't happen that way, Lucy," Jane said archly.
"How the hell do you know?" Lucy shot back.
Leah took out the first egg and studied it as it gleamed in the May sunshine. She handled it with great delicacy and made sure the egg was facing in the same direction as it was when she removed it from its original nest. Her head almost disappeared from sight as she set the egg in its place, as seriously as a priest laying a consecrated host on the altar cloth. When the first egg was put in, Leah looked to the adults for approval and received it from all three of us. It took Leah almost 1/2 hour to fill up that hole with turtle eggs, and the job went more quickly as she gained confidence in her handling and placement of them. When she began, each egg was precious, and by the time she finished, the eggs felt familiar and comfortable in her hand. Then Lucy taught her how to cover the eggs with the same sand they had taken from the hole, and pack it down with the same firmness a 300-pound mother would exert in her desire to camouflage the nest from the eyes of predators. They were smoothing out the sand above the nest, and Jane was moving the wire cage over toward the nest, when the sound of a male voice on the deck startled them all.
"Is that bitch bothering you again, Mama?" the voice said,
and I looked up to see my brother, John Harden, staring out over the scene, shirtless behind a gate.
"I forgot to tell you, Jack, your brother got in from Columbia late last night."
"Hey, John Harden," Jane said, putting the wire fence in place above the nest. "The bitch is only bothering your Mama a little bit. Nothing to write home about."
"Should I beat her up, Mama?" John Harden asked.
"Hush up. They'll be hauling you back up to Bull Street if you can't put a brake on your tongue,"
Lucy said. "Thanks a lot for visiting me in the hospital, Jack," John Harden said, spotting me for the first time. "Every visiting hour I kept waiting for you to come and bring me some boiled peanuts and Heath bars, the way you used to. But no, you've gotten too big for John Harden. You're much too busy shitting on French restaurants and writing whoopie-doo pieces on sun-dried tomatoes and balsamic vinegar to ever come visit your little brother on the crazy ward."
"Shut up, John Harden. Your brother's still recuperating from getting himself shot up in Rome."
"Well, I forgot about that, Jack," John Harden said. "I'm so sorry. I read all about your being hurt, and I wanted to fly straight to Rome to take care of you. Isn't that right, Mama?"
"That's certainly right, honey," she said, checking Jane's handiwork and placing the wire screen over the nest. Then, in a lower voice, she whispered to me, "In the condition he was in, he could have flown all the way there and not even bothered to call Delta."
"Who is that pretty thing?" John Harden said, spotting Leah. "Is that the lovely Miss Leah McCall?"
"Hello, Uncle John Harden."
"Run up here and give your uncle a big kiss," John Harden said, as Leah looked pleadingly at me. Then John Harden opened the gate, and I saw for the first time that he was wearing no clothes at all. I shook my head and said, "Why don't you put on some clothes, John Harden? Leah's never hugged a totally naked man before."
"Thanks, Daddy," Leah whispered.
Both Jane and Lucy turned away from the fencing and looked at John Harden, who stood proudly unclad and unapologetic above them. "I became a nudist while at the state hospital, Mother," John Harden said. "It's a matter of principle with me, and I know you'll support my decision. It's an act of faith, not of folly, of that I assure you."
"Get your goddamn clothes on, boy," Lucy said murderously, "or I'm going to knock your unmentionables into the Atlantic with this shovel. Cover yourself up before this innocent young woman. I never heard of such carrying on in broad daylight."
She took off Jane Hartley's hat and shielded the young woman's eyes from the sight of her son's pale genitalia.
"I'm a scientist, Lucy. This doesn't shock me."
"I'm a mother, Jane, and this shocks the living hell out of me," Lucy said. "Call the crazy house, Jack, and tell them they didn't come close to fixing what ails the nudist here."
"This is the way God made me, Leah," John Harden said. "Do you see anything revolting or disgusting in God's work? I admit my dick's kind of ugly, but who are we to criticize the Lord's handiwork? Don't you agree?"
"What's a dick, Daddy?" Leah asked me.
"American slang for penis," I said.
"Thank you, Daddy."
"You're very welcome, sweetheart."
"I think your dick is very pretty, John Harden," Leah said kindly.
"See, Mama, you uptight Puritan asshole," John Harden screamed. "Beauty's in the eye of the pretender."
"You mean beholder," Lucy corrected.
"I mean exactly what I say I mean, and nothing more."
"Good. Say anything you want. Just go put something over your elementals."
"Elementals," John Harden said. "This ain't Plymouth Rock, Mother dear. It won't hurt you to say the word dick, or hairy banana, or cock, or pecker."
"Those are the words I was talking about the other day, Daddy," Leah said. "Those are the ones I hear on the playground."
"Once you know them all, you're well on your way to being an American girl." "I came into the world buck naked," John Harden said.
"I seem to remember that," Lucy said to Jane. "Would you like a cup of coffee?"
"Love one," Jane said.
"And naked shall I return to my true mother, the earth, not that woman that claims to have brought me forth in vileness and unholy jeopardy. That dog walking on the beach is naked, that seagull, that pelican, that porpoise offshore, all naked and natural as they were on the day when they first saw their mothers in sunlight. I saw sunlight, then I saw this unfeeling bitch who raised me, Jane, and turned me into a lunatic to walk the earth unloved and uninvited into any home."
"Put your pants on and join us for coffee, son," Lucy said, washing her feet and hands of sand.
"You spoke nicely to me, Mama," John Harden said. "I will join you. You catch more snakes with honey than Caesar did in Gaul."
"What did John Harden mean about the honey, Daddy?" asked Leah.
"He wants me to speak nicely to him," Lucy answered. "He's got an odd relationship with the English language."
"Did you know that nudists commit fewer murders than any other group, Jane?" John Harden asked.
"I never knew that," Jane said, "but it doesn't surprise me."
"I scare you, don't I?" John Harden said to Jane Hartley. "You've never met a full-fledged, bona fide schizophrenic in your life, and I can see the fear in your eyes."
"Shut up, son," Lucy said.
handing him a beach towel that he wrapped around himself as she crossed the deck and walked through the sliding glass doors into her living room. "You don't need to present your credentials. Being stark naked's all the clue anyone needs."
"My sister's schizophrenic, John Harden," Jane said, following Lucy into the house. "Your act's old to me."
John Harden watched the young woman as she crossed the deck and disappeared inside the house.
"She's very pretty, isn't she, Jack?"
"Very pretty."
"Do you think she liked me, Leah?" John Harden asked, and his voice was tender.
"She'd like you better with clothes," Leah said.
"That's prejudice," he said,
his voice darkening an octave.
"She's used to boys wearing clothes, that's all," Leah said.
"Oh."
John Harden seemed mollified.
"I've never known how to talk to pretty girls. Maybe you could help me, Leah. You're pretty. In fact, I bet you'll be elected Miss Italy someday. Unless you come back here, where you'll be Miss America."
"Talk to her like that, John Harden," Leah said. "Maybe she'd like that."
"I know you're supposed to say hi to girls. I always do that. Then I know you're supposed to say something like, 'Isn't this a beautiful day?' I say that when the day's nice, but what do you say when it's rainy or cold? And what do you say after that? I mean, there's a million things you could say, but what does a pretty girl want to hear after a weather report? It's a mystery to me, Leah. Does she want to know that there was an earthquake in Pakistan last night? Well, that's pretty important. Or would she rather know how a Jerry Lewis movie ended that I saw the other night in the hospital? Or makeup? Maybe she'd like to talk about makeup, but, see, I don't use it. I'd be glad to talk about anything, but too many things come to my mind, and I end up saying nothing. Pretty girls hate me, Leah."
"No, they don't," Leah said. "They know just how you feel. Tell them what you just told us. Tell Miss Hartley. She'll understand."
"Now? Go in right now?"
No, let everything come up naturally. Wait till it feels right," Leah said.
"Oh, I can't," John Harden said. "Nothing ever feels right to me."
The next day I drove Leah to the southwest tangent of the Isle of Orion to visit John Harden in the treehouse he had built for himself, so he had a place to go whenever he felt the need to withdraw from society. The treehouse was much discussed on both the island and Waterford, but seldom seen. John Harden had built his pied-à-terre in a 200-year-old live oak that hung over the tidal creek that cut a necklace of deep water through the great salt marsh. Since he was good with his hands and had enormous amounts of free time, the treehouse had expanded over the years, gone through several renovations, and had 5 separate rooms plus a screened-in porch when I drove up beneath it and blew the horn to alert my brother. At the extreme end of the road, I pointed out to Leah the unpainted wooden building that my brothers and I had built and used as a fish camp all throughout our childhood days. It surprised me that the floating deck was in such good shape until I remembered that John Harden lived here almost full time when he was not locked up in the state hospital. The treehouse was made from heart of pine and stained a natural color. There was both charm and eccentricity in its architecture, and the rooms grew smaller and more turret-like as they spiraled up the tree, accommodating themselves to the higher and frailer branches. Everywhere the eye looked, there were bird feeders and bird baths and wind chimes. The air could not move without music moving through every leaf and acorn on the tree. Most of the wind chimes were handmade, and their music was slightly off-key and eccentric. But the house seemed spacious and congruent, and Leah screamed with delight. From above, we heard John Harden call down to us, and he lowered a wooden ladder from his living area. The house had 3 decks ingeniously constructed. On the top deck, John Harden had built a small bedroom for himself, with a hammock and a library filled with paperback books. He lit his uncommon house with candles and kerosene lanterns, and cooked his meals with a small hibachi. The ocean breeze was his only air conditioning, and John Harden freely admitted that his treehouse was unusable during the winter. But historically, the cold months had almost always coincided with his breakdowns, and he had availed himself of the free lodging that always awaited him on Bull Street in Columbia. In the creek, he caught most of his own food with his cast net and his rod and reel. Proud of his self-sufficiency, he pointed out his outhouse, camouflaged in a thick clump of sea myrtle.
"It's illegal to have an outhouse on this stupid island," John Harden said to Leah. "Zoning laws. There's a conspiracy afoot in America to make human beings ashamed of their waste products. I'm proud of my waste products."
"I've never thought much about mine,"
Leah said, smiling at me and following John Harden into a small, bizarrely shaped room, almost completely dominated by a Pawley's Island hammock.
This is the guest bedroom. I haven't had any guests yet, but when I do, this'll be where they sleep. You can come here any time you want, Leah. You don't even need an invitation.
Thank you so much, John Harden. You're so sweet.
It's strictly off-limits to the rest of my family. I better never catch your ass sneaking around my property, Jack.
Wouldn't think of it, I said, feeling overgrown and claustrophobic as I made my way from one small enclosure to another. There were tricks to getting from room to room, and very little appeared solid underfoot, and I had the feeling that I was on a yacht anchored in an open bay on a windy afternoon. John Harden had decorated the walls of his sitting room with art given to him by fellow inmates of the state hospital. The paintings looked like stamps minted in a country where nightmares were used to lure a strange breed of tourist. It was a desperate cousin of art, disturbing in all its forms and images.
All artists are schizophrenics, John Harden said to Leah. Did you know that, Leah?
I don't think so.
They all see the world with a skewed perspective. They paint what they know best, distortion.
Are these friends of yours? Leah asked.
The only friends worth knowing. The ones who've been on Thorazine for at least a year. Thorazine keeps you so far away from yourself that your art becomes the only clue that lets you know you're still around.
That's nice, Leah said, but nervously, aware she might be saying the wrong thing to her taut, thin-skinned uncle. I'll paint some pictures for the guest room. Would you like that?
John Harden's face grew soft as he said,
I'd treasure them forever. You can bet on that.
I'll paint a picture of the Piazza Farnese in Rome, she promised. I miss it so much that I can see the whole piazza when I shut my eyes.
You miss it that much, darling? I asked.
Of course, Daddy, that's home.
Waterford's home, John Harden said. Everything else is just local color.
But Rome's where I grew up, Leah said. You'd love it there.
I've never liked people who can't speak English, John Harden said. I always think they've got something to hide.
How ridiculous, I said. How southern.
No matter, John Harden said, as he led us to the largest room, which had three lawn chairs, a hammock, and a screened porch to keep out the insects.
John Harden showed real talent for carpentry, and, despite the hazardous footing, the rooms seemed to flow together with an unplanned naturalness, as if the house were the result of a dream the tree had. A breeze lifted off the ocean, and several hundred notes from the wind chimes tinkled like ice shaken in silver cups. They altered the mood of the forest the way an orchestra does a theater when it begins tuning up its instruments. The sound seemed discordant to me, but had a calming effect on John Harden. John Harden took a piece of paper out of his pocket and read it to himself silently before saying to Leah,
I wrote something out that I'd love your help with. I could see that you were kind of an expert on how men and women interact yesterday.
No, she said. I've never even had a boyfriend.
But you know how I should talk to Jane Hartley if I want to impress her.
You should be yourself, John Harden. She'd like that.
Well, listen to this, he asked. You play the role of Jane, I'll play myself.
Jesus Christ, I said.
It's fine, Daddy, Leah said, before I could continue. Read it to me, and I'll try to play Miss Hartley.
She's a naturalist, a scientist, so I should try to carry on a conversation that interests her. Let her know right up front that we share mutual concerns. So we've sat down to dinner and ordered our meal. I ordered all vegetables. What if she's a vegetarian? Or hates people that don't mind eating the animals she's taken a vow to protect? That'd start the evening off wrong.
I'd order whatever you feel like eating, John Harden, Leah suggested.
A good idea, he said, writing something down on his sheet of paper. I'll order fish. Even if she's a vegetarian, I happen to know that some vegetarians don't mind eating seafood, and I love fish. But now you say something. Pretend you're Jane.
Leah hesitated, then said,
What a beautiful tie you're wearing tonight, John Harden. It goes so well with your suit. It's nice that you're not a nudist anymore.
John Harden looked confused, then looked down at his notes and said,
Did you know, Jane, that the male night moth emits a cry so powerful that its sound creates waves that can actually kill other insects in flight?
He looked up at Leah, who was puzzled but game. She said,
No, I didn't know that. How interesting.
The male night moth is the terror of the insect world,
John Harden read again from his notes. Did you know that recent research proves that alligators like the taste of Labrador retrievers better than the taste of French poodles? Researchers believe that alligators are so accustomed to living near golf resorts and residential homes, they've actually added domestic dogs to the preferred meals on their food chain.
Those poor dogs, said Leah in genuine horror.
Isn't the weather lovely, Jane? John Harden read on.
Yes, it's getting warmer every day, John Harden, Leah said, glancing at me to see if she was performing up to par.
I nodded, and Leah went on.
Do you think it might rain tomorrow?
Funny you should mention rain. It reminds me of snow. Do you know that a female polar bear will cover her nose with her paw when she's hunting a seal near an air hole? That's because her nose is black, and the snow around her is all white. The bear becomes invisible as she creeps up to the seal to make her kill.
How do you know so much about nature? Leah asked.
John Harden smiled and began to read from his written text. Because it is my conviction that man himself is part of nature, and that to study nature is to study one's own self. A spider must eat a fly just as a man must eat a cheeseburger. It's all related and one and the same. I'd cut the fly on the cheeseburger line, I said, my nerves becoming frayed by the wind chimes. Well, food is food. In nature it don't make a damn. Jane's intelligent enough to get my drift.
Maybe you could say, a horse eats oats, Leah said. A fly is sort of disgusting.
Well, great idea, Leah. You're sensitive the way Jane's sensitive, John Harden said. You aren't sensitive for shit, Jack.
Thanks, I said, then caught sight of a boat rounding the bend of Sawgrass Creek.
That's Ladere. You want to go for a boat ride with us, John Harden? She says she's got a surprise for us.
No, he said. I'm going to stay here and work on my imaginary conversation with Jane Hartley. Do you have any suggestions for me, Leah? Any inside stuff that might let me know how pretty girls think?
Leah took her uncle's hand and kissed him on the cheek.
Everybody wants a friend. Just let Jane know how much you like her, and everything else will be fine.
I'm going to the library tomorrow to read all their books on nature. By the time I take her to dinner, I'll know more about animals than anyone she ever met.
When are you thinking about taking her, John Harden? I asked.
It'll be years, he said. It'll take 2 or 3 years just studying before I could even think about asking her out.
But she could meet someone else, Leah said.
Well, that's the chance I'll have to take, John Harden said, as Leah and I went down the wooden ladder. Well, don't tell anyone about my treehouse, he warned, as he joined us on the ground. My enemies are everywhere, and it drives them crazy when they hear that I'm a free man.
Your secrets are safe with us, I said, and turned to watch the powerboat approaching us from a mile away. Its drone was comforting, so familiar was it to this low country boy that it could not wake me even from a fitful sleep.
As we walked past the old fish camp, John Harden unlocked its door and invited us inside. I was glad to see that he had fixed the place up, repaired the broken windows, and even painted it on the inside. The wood-burning stove was still in its corner, and the same mildewed cots hugged the far wall, but John Harden was using it for a workshop now, and his tools were well-ordered and in immaculate condition. There was a pile of fresh lumber, clean-smelling and newly cut.
"Do you know why I bought the wood?" he asked.
"No idea. I'm going to build a coffin for Mama."
"What a ghastly idea," I said. "Does she know?"
"Of course she doesn't know. It's going to be a surprise," John Harden said, clearly hurt by my tone of voice. "It's one less thing she'll have to worry about. I'll build it strong. It'll be beautiful."
"She'll like that very much," Leah said.
"I'm not so sure," I said.
Leah cast her eyes disapprovingly at me and said, "My father's wrong. It's a wonderful thing."
"It'll be a work of art, Jack, you'll see. It'll be the most beautiful coffin ever seen in this county,"
John Harden said, looking around as though intruders were listening to him.
"This county is so full of drunkards and perjurers and scoundrels, whoremongers, Satanists, and tax evaders."
"Tax evaders," I said.
"Well, I don't have to pay taxes because of my status as a schizophrenic, but there are people who don't fill out any forms for the Internal Revenue Service. They're lower than fungi, mushrooms that grow on logs."
"Why don't you go out on the boat with us?" Leah asked.
John Harden watched the boat as it slowed down to make its approach to the dock.
"No, you go on," he said, and like an animal, he ran back to the tree, went swiftly up the ladder, drew it in,
and shut the hard world out from under him again. Ladair watched us as we peeled off shirts and pants, revealing our bathing suits underneath. As we stepped aboard, she motioned for Leah to come sit between her legs and take the wheel. "You're not a low country girl until you can handle a boat," Ladair said. "Pull the gear back to reverse, and let's head out toward Waterford Sound." Leah did as she was told, and the boat began to move slowly back into the middle of the creek. "Turn the wheel to the right and straighten out the rudder," Ladair said. I watched as Leah followed the instructions closely. Her dark intensity burned brightly, in contrast to Ladair's generous blondness. Leah seemed inked by the sun, while Ladair looked as though the sun had left no sign of its passage in the hue of her skin. "The tide's still coming in and is almost high," Ladair said. "Don't worry about sandbars." "How fast can we go?" Leah asked. "Let her rip, child," Ladair said. "When you're a kid, you've got to get speed out of your system."
Leah opened up the throttle, and the boat, a 16-foot Rankin, Charleston made, lifted up out of the displaced water and cut through the main channel between the Isle of Orion and the uninhabited Barnwell Island. Ladair pointed the way as we navigated the backwaters behind the barrier islands, and the Spartina spread out in a vast green coverlet from horizon to horizon. When we reached the Waterford River, Ladair gave a sign for Leah to slow down and put the boat in idle. I worked my way between them, opened a beer, and sat down heavily, taking the wheel. I adjusted my Atlanta Braves baseball cap and put more sunscreen on my face and neck as Ladair untangled rope in the stern of the boat. Then she fed the rope out behind the boat a little at a time, handling it expertly like a trapeze artist testing equipment under the big top. "What are you doing, Ladair?" Leah asked. "See that look in her eye?" I said. She was the 4-time winner of the Sea Island Water Festival skiing tournament.
5-time, Ladair corrected. "And that's boys and girls, darling. I can ski better than any boy who ever grew up in this town."
"Better than Daddy?"
Ladair laughed and looked fondly at me.
"Your daddy's a nice boy, Leah, but he can't hold the top part of my bikini when it comes to water skiing. Tell her, Jack, swallow your male pride and give it to her straight."
"She's arrogant beyond belief," I said. "But the girl ain't human when she gets on skis. Then she's poetry in motion. A goddess of the sea." Ladair jumped into the water feet first, and Leah followed her example as I put the boat into forward gear and inched ahead, pulling the tow rope toward the two swimming figures behind me. Suddenly, it was as though I was transported into 1,000 afternoons of my childhood, when the smell of the river and the sound of motors purring overwhelmed me with a sense of deeply entered and deeply lived out time. I could remember 100 images of Ladair cutting through the water on her slalom, leaning into a turn so steep that she looked as though she were lying down against the surface of the water. All the laws of physics and all the beauty of geometry seemed to come into play when Ladair took to the water behind a fast boat. I watched as she coached and encouraged Leah, and remembered how, for most of my growing up, I had assumed that Ladair would become the mother of my children. I watched as Ladair positioned Leah's hands on the tow bar and placed her feet in the skis and adjusted them tightly. There was nothing that Ladair did in the water that did not seem graceful. She appeared water-bred and water-happy, and she swam in a circle around a slightly frightened, yet fiercely excited Leah, who had inherited an unquenchable competitive spirit from me. She hated failure, and hated especially to have witnesses to that failure. But Ladair calmed her, instructed her to keep her skis together and her arms straight, and to let the boat do all the work. After putting on her own skis, she positioned herself behind Leah and placed Leah between her legs, with her skis outside of Leah's. She put her hands outside of Leah's hands on the tow bar and gave me the signal to gun the motor. Looking back, I saw that Leah had let go of the tow bar as soon as she heard the roar of the engine, and that Ladair had dropped her handhold at the same time. She was gently talking to Leah as I circled the boat and brought the bar floating on top of the surface directly into Ladair's hands as she repositioned both of them for another try. "A tight grip, then arms straight out. You can't bend the arms. Get the skis on either side of the rope." "Oh, perfect, Leah. Now I'm going to signal your daddy, and we're going to ski through town." Leah held on the second time, and she rose up on her skis, her weight leaning against Ladair's legs.
They came out of the water together, Ladere's legs spread wide as she nursed her young skier along, and they went for 200 yards before Leah lost a ski and fell. Ladere fell simultaneously and swam to retrieve Leah's ski in the wake of the boat. Again Ladere gave the signal, Leah got up, and this time they passed together through town, with Leah not daring to move a muscle, and Ladere waving to passers-by along the waterfront park. They went under the bridge, and Leah caught a quick glimpse of cars passing above them. Touching Leah on the shoulder, Ladere pointed toward the wake on the starboard side of the boat, and using the pressure of her left hand, urged Leah away from the boat. The two of them pointed their skis at the marina down Oyster Creek, and, twinned in motion, they moved as one skier, riding over the wake, then racing along outside the boat, swift and lovely and graceful, in their strange but buoyant pas de deux. I heard Leah squeal with joy and watched as Ladere coached her. And then the rope slackened, and they waited for that precise moment when they felt its tension again, and they let the power of the boat take control, bringing them swiftly back across the wake, and then over the opposite one in two perfect leaps. I could hear Ladere talking above the noise of the motor, but could not make out the words. But I saw Leah relax and gain confidence under Ladere's patient tutelage. One can do anything, anything at all, I thought, if provided with a passionate and gifted teacher. I made a circular motion with my index finger, but Leah fell again as I turned the boat in a slow 180-degree curve. When I came back around, Ladere insisted I throw another ski rope from the back of the boat so that she and Leah could ski separately behind the boat. "Is Leah ready for that?" I asked. "She's a natural," Ladere said, nodding toward Leah. And natural she was, as I gunned the motor once more, and woman and girl rose out of the Waterford River in tandem, both screaming with pleasure, as I pulled them again through the center of town, past the many-columned mansions set between the live oaks of Water Street. I thought of Venice, that city lifted out of the Adriatic, each palace sensual and removed, as though designed by architects in love with the shape of orchids and wedding cakes. But I could not deny the fact that the simplicity and spacing and proportion of the houses of Waterford stirred my sense of aesthetics as much as any canal ride in Venice. For over a half hour, I pulled them up and down the Waterford River. Then, heeding a signal from Ladere that Leah was tiring, I anchored the boat on the sandbar directly across from the town. After they climbed up into the boat and toweled themselves dry, Ladere passed out tomato sandwiches, made with tomatoes from her mother's garden, lettuce, mayonnaise, and Vidalia onions. I moaned with pleasure as I bit into the sandwich, and the rich juice spilled out of the sandwich and down my face and arms. I opened the sandwich to inspect the slice of tomato I had just tasted. It was large and fire engine red, and glistened with juice and health. I remembered long ago when I had gone out into a field with my grandfather, who had leaned down and cut a ripe tomato from a vine heavy with fruit. Silas had peeled the tomato with his pocket knife, then salted slices and handed them to me. I could not imagine that nectar in paradise could have tasted any better than that freshly picked tomato. And for me, that taste has always been, and will be, the taste of Waterford and summer. The day was ending when we started back for the Isle of Orion, the sun playing along the surface of the water, turning a bank of cumulus clouds red in the west. On the way, we called out the buoys and channel markers, and I could feel my sunburn start to tighten my face as the air cooled. As we passed Ladyface Island, Ladere suddenly pointed to a creek that I had fished when I was a boy. It was on an isolated back side of the island that had escaped most of the overdevelopment that was changing the composition and feel of all the low country. "Go by Henry Thomas's place," Ladere said. "I haven't seen Henry since high school," I said. "He still have his welding business?"
"Went broke welding. He's in construction over on Hilton Head. The whole known world's in construction on Hilton Head. I saw him in the Piggly Wiggly the other day. He asked about you."
"Henry and I played football together," I explained to Leah. "He was a player." Leah asked through glazed, exhausted eyes,
"What's that supposed to mean?"
"Well, the boy was tough. He'd tear your head off if he got the chance."
"A redneck?" Leah ventured. "Like my uncles talk about?" "Of the purest variety," Ledare said. "The grade-A high-test kind. He could hide forever at the Darlington 500. That's a car race, darling."
"Henry's simple, but a real good citizen," I said.
"I went by his place last week. He wanted me to meet his youngest son," Ledare said. "He has Down syndrome, but he's a sweetheart. Let's go see him."
"Leah's tired," I complained.
"I want Leah to see this," she said.
As the tide went out, the boat rode lower in the marshes, and I made my way down long corridors of the marsh grass we had ridden above just hours ago. There was a time in my life I knew all these creeks well enough to navigate at night without ever consulting a chart. But now I consulted a map twice to check for bars and low water before I brought the boat inside of Henry Thomas's house. It was an old wooden farmhouse with a screened-in porch that ran along the front. Four vehicles were parked around the yard, one permanently. A cock crowed somewhere in a field beyond the house, and an egret hunted beneath the pylons of Henry's dock until he flushed when our boat drew too near his hunting grounds. Ledare pointed to a spot 20 yards across the creek where the water was shallower and whispered for me to cut the motor and drop anchor.
"Aren't we going to go to the dock and say hello to Henry?"
"Shh," Ledare said, putting a finger to her lips. "He knows we're here. I told him we were coming."
The sunset turned the marsh gold, and the western sky transformed itself into a window of rose and violet as its edges flowered and dimpled in its final burning haze. The water around us caught fire, and the boat rested in a pool of cold flame. In silence, we watched the water shimmer like a peacock's feather in that shining foil of soft tide in retreat. Leah put her hand down and touched the lemony surface of the water. A little boy ran out of Henry Thomas's house, followed at a distance by his mother and father and two older sisters. The boy wore a T-shirt and shorts, a pair of black high-top sneakers, and a tiny life preserver. Yet he was fearless as he ran, slowing only when he inched his way down the ramp to the floating dock.
"His name is Oliver," Ledare whispered,
as Leah and I watched the boy thrust out his arms toward the sunset on the marsh and begin to spin in graceful circles. His thin, high-pitched voice broke out in song, and though the words were difficult to make out, I recognized the tune of Mary Had a Little Lamb. Oliver looked toward the water expectantly, but saw nothing, and cried out in surprise or frustration. Going down on his knees, he began to beat his hands against the warped, unpainted boards, singing another song, the words again unrecognizable, but the tune haunting and familiar.
"Rock of Ages," Ledare whispered to Leah.
Looking toward his family, Oliver, bewildered and hurt, threw his hands up, then began stamping his feet hard against the dock, and his incessant tattoo echoed through the marsh. He began a third song and then a fourth. His family watched in motionless silence, although Henry waved once to welcome the visitors in the boat.
"Here it comes," Ledare said.
A dorsal fin, curved as beautifully as a gondola, broke the still waters 200 yards away, coming out of much deeper water. The porpoise came swiftly, its green body jonquil-colored in the last light, then the color of straw, then the touch of ecru, until it rose out of the water when it approached the dock where Oliver sang. It lifted its head, and Leah stood up and leaned forward when she heard the porpoise emit high-pitched sounds of its own. The boy spun in delirious circles and began to speak or scream or croak out sounds, too excited to have the discipline of language. If it was speech, it was dissonant and inhuman and strange. Oliver's face was lit with ecstasy, and he put his arms out toward the porpoise and sang the tune to "Jesus Loves Me" to the bottlenosed creature, and all the long-legged, waiting birds paused to listen to this strange outcry, this primitive interlude between sunset and night. As the boy grew more excited, his voice grew shriller and less distinct. The voice seemed to calm the porpoise, which swam in slow circles, rising out of the water to make quieter noises of its own. Oliver's song had an eerie, unworldly harmony to it, but the porpoise's voice seemed half-human and more familiar. The rapture of the boy increased, and he danced and pointed toward the porpoise and looked back toward his family.
At the very end, Oliver was grunting and squeaking unintelligible sounds, and ever so often the porpoise would answer with a far away and much sadder sound. When the porpoise turned back toward the sea, Oliver screamed out in protest, then waved furious and petulant goodbyes, then sank to his knees, motionless, exhausted. Henry came down to the dock in half-light and lifted Oliver up in his arms. He waved to all of us in the boat, then walked the boy back to his family. For a full minute, the three of us in the boat were quiet, still in the scene we had witnessed. We could not name what we had just seen, but we knew it was a rare form of communion and dialogue.
"What was Oliver saying to that porpoise, Daddy?" Leah asked at last.
"Something wonderful, I think," I said, "but I don't know."
"Guess," she said.
"I know what they were saying," Ladere said, as I started the motor.
"Tell me," Leah said. "Oliver's saying to the porpoise, 'Does Jack love Ladere? Does Jack love Ladere?' And the porpoise is answering, 'He should, he should.'"
Leah rode in Ladere's lap as we followed in the wake of the porpoise as it headed out the sea lanes for the Atlantic, and the stars shone on us with a brightness of complete indifference. Chapter 29. For me, memory was the country of the usable past, but now I began to wonder if there was not also a danger to unremembrance. I had recently become acutely aware that mistranslation, mistakes of emphasis, and the inevitability of a flawed interpretation of an experience could lead to an imperfect view of things. I had thought that Shiloh was fairly happy in our marriage, though I knew well the history of her moods and depressions and migraines. I began to think I had underestimated the battalion strength of those malignant, subterranean demons that took her in despair to that bridge. I had always thought her sadness was part of Shiloh's depth, for there was nothing I distrusted in people more than sunniness, personalities whose optimism seemed unearned. Shiloh was full of so many deep places that I often felt she was exploring some newly discovered country of glaciers and ice fields whenever her black, indwelling spirits took possession of her. Part of her allure was also her buoyancy and unpredictability. Shiloh could not be kept down long, but I knew I had failed to recognize the flip side to this virtue, that her time in the sunshine was limited because her truest self lay in her most inaccessible places. As I told Leah stories of her mother, I kept coming upon images that had failed to speak their importance at the time. Following the music of her interior, Shiloh had gone straight to a rendezvous with her own hangman. When I began the hard work of trying to figure out the course that had led to Shiloh's destruction, I recalled strong images that I had carried intact without knowing what they really meant. Now I realized that Shiloh had seemed embarrassed by her parents from the time I had any memory of the foxes at all. Their accents embarrassed her. Their foreignness caused her shame. Very early, Shiloh used to spend afternoons at our house, soaking up the rowdy atmosphere of an American home that seemed normal to her. Whenever she smelled hamburgers or popcorn or fried chicken being prepared in my mother's kitchen, Shiloh would appear at the back door with her timid knock, and Lucy would invite her in to feast on whatever was cooking. I remembered well the first birthday party the foxes gave Shiloh. My mother had taken Shiloh and me to a movie matinee at the Breeze Theater, where we saw Come Back Little Sheba with Shirley Booth. The film was an odd choice for children our age, but it was the only movie in town, and my mother had no choice but to sit through the entire film as Shiloh and I wandered the aisles and even ventured upstairs to the colored section, which we found completely empty. The discovery thrilled us, and my mother had to come looking for us in the middle of the film, and found us taking turns drawing tattoos on each other's arms in ballpoint pen. Before we left the movie house, Lucy scrubbed both tattoos off with Kleenex and her own saliva. The party was to be a surprise, and when Shiloh came through the front door, her father played a baroque and spirited rendition of Happy Birthday that intimidated the Waterford children into an uneasy silence. Ruth and George and Lucy were the only ones who sang, and Shiloh had her face in her hands as she saw some of the neighborhood boys snickering at her father's guttural accent. Then George Fox announced, as though he were talking to a sophisticated audience at Carnegie Hall, that he had prepared a very special concert in honor of his daughter's birthday. The 10 children invited to Schala's party then had to sit still as George Fox played Liszt's Hungarian Rhapsody No. 2. After the concert had mercifully ended, the awestruck but very restless children were herded into a dining room that was formally set and lit by silver candelabra. Schala wore a bewildered expression that could have been disbelief or fear, but her face looked as though it had been flash-frozen. She knew what was coming, but felt helpless to interfere with the course of events. "So," her mother said, as her classmates sat in formal misery around the table, "now we eat like pigs, a feast for my sweet Schala, who was born, as you know, on this day. She is an American girl, and she should have an American birthday, no?" Ruth pronounced the word girl like gull, and the children at the table did not understand a single word she said. Several of the boys went under the table to hide their laughter. Only my mother's presence kept any semblance of order, and she circled the table 3 times, quelling the outbursts of silliness by the boys. But even my mother could not control the amazement that broke spontaneously from the children's mouths when Ruth uncovered the numerous bowls which contained the feast she had been days secretly preparing for her daughter. There was borscht and sour cream, which none of us had ever seen, a Russian salad composed of mayonnaise, peas, and flakes of salmon, and something called cheese kreplach. One boy, Samuel Burbage, threw up in his own lap when he tasted pickled herring and sour cream. Hot tea was served in glass cups with handles, and a plate of handmade Kaiser rolls was passed around the entire table without a single taker. Gefilte fish brought cries of amazement, and several of the boys discovered happily a bowl of hard-boiled eggs that they identified and quickly passed around as the one food recognizably American. Schala endured her trial without commentary, but I remember the relief on her face when Ruth Fox returned to the dining room, followed by my mother, carrying a frosted birthday cake decked out with lighted candles. My mother led the children in a spirited rendition of Happy Birthday, then took the cake out to the front porch to get all the children away from the scene of Mrs. Fox's crime. Outside, Schala blew out the candles, and then the presents were brought out to be opened. Lucy then organized a game of hide-and-seek for all the boys and girls. But as Lucy was organizing the game in the front yard, Ruth was weeping while she cleaned the table of dishes full of untouched food. My mother had saved Schala's party by making the children forget about what they could not bring themselves to eat, but not for long. When Samuel Burbage's mother came to retrieve her son, he screamed out as he ran to her, "They gave us raw fish and whipped cream, Mama. I puked when I ate it." Harper Price's mother heard that her daughter had burned her tongue on the tea and that the doughnuts were hard as rocks. "They're called bagels," Schala tried to explain. "My mother bought them at Gottlieb's in Savannah." Capers Middleton had never seen red soup, and Ladea had never eaten cold fish or sweetened noodles, and Elmer Bazemore, a shrimper's son, took only one taste of gefilte fish before he spit it out on his napkin. He swore to his parents that he had no idea where they found such a fish in American waters, and that the flesh of that Jewish fish had actually burned his tongue and caused him to ask Mrs. Fox for several glasses of water. Later, Ruth Fox explained that she had probably served the gefilte fish with too much horseradish. The utter foreignness of Schala's household became a minor obsession of her friends and classmates in Waterford. Children are born with a herd instinct, and nothing causes them to suffer more than habits of their parents that single out the child for censure and ridicule. Schala spent her childhood aching to be an American. Yet it was deeper and more extraordinary than that. Schala Fox yearned for another unreachable level of Americanism. She tried to turn herself into a Southerner, that most elusive and evasive American of all. Her whole life became a quiet devotional to mimicry. Every year her accent differed and thickened as she listened to the collective voices of the women in her town. The idioms of Southern speech delighted her as much as her parents' use of Yiddish appalled her. She became tyrannical and refused to let them converse in Yiddish when she was present. Their Yiddish was out of place and discordant in a land of azaleas, hominy, plantation tours, onion rings, buttered popcorn, Necco wafers, and 3 Musketeers candy bars, big enough to share with a pal.
"She thinks she is a Yankee Doodle dandy," her father would often scoff.
"She wants a normal life," her mother would argue. "Show me the great sin. It's the same thing I want for her."
It was more intuition than knowledge that led me to believe the atmosphere in the house across the yard was off-kilter and bizarre. That they celebrated holidays I had never heard of and could not pronounce seemed exotic enough, and I used to try to get Ruth Fox to teach me dirty words in Yiddish so I could torment my brothers when they got on my nerves. But there was something deeply disturbing and unsettled in the house of Fox that no one in my small town could begin to fathom. It was not merely foreignness that set their house apart, but a sadness so profound that it settled like a killing dust in every square inch of those immaculate, spacious rooms. George and Ruth Fox were afraid of dogs and cats and their own shadows. I could see them peeking out at me from behind closed curtains whenever I would come knocking at the back door. They jumped whenever there was an unexpected knock at the door. Their hands trembled when they answered a ringing telephone. When Ruth Fox hung laundry to dry in the sun, she kept looking around for the movement of enemies on her flank. For years and years, I tried to decipher what was wrong. I spied and eavesdropped and watched the quiet motion of their family as I monitored their activities from the branches of the oak tree after dark. The only thing I could ever come up with was that Shala's parents seemed to grow darker, not older. Mr. Fox would often wake up screaming in the middle of the night during nightmares he had brought with him to this country. When I asked Shyla what made her father scream at night, she told me I must be dreaming myself, that she had never heard a thing. Once I heard him scream out the name of a woman, but it was no one I'd ever heard of, nor anyone who had ever lived in our neighborhood. After he awoke with his strange woman's name on his lips, and as I moved along the branches of the moonlit oak that gave me access to such secrets, I heard Ruth comforting her husband. Listening to this sorrowful and intimate scene, I pinched myself hard, for Shiloh's sake, to make sure I was not dreaming. I tried to overhear their conversation, but they were speaking to each other in another language. Though I could not understand that language, I knew enough about words to know that Ruth loved George Fox beyond all measure and time. In the years that followed Shiloh's party, the sense of darkness and unhappiness in the Fox household seemed to deepen. I often thought perhaps it came from George Fox's fanatical absorption with his music. All of us were afraid of Mr. Fox, with his impeccable old-world manners, his disfigured hand, his suffering, and his reticence that seemed unnatural when accompanied by his baleful glare. Though his music students adored him, they were gathered up from the most sensitive and highly strung children. At night, as I tried to go to sleep, I listened to Mr. Fox play the piano, and I learned from those evening recitals that music could ache and hurt, that beautiful music was a place a suffering man could hide. I remember when I first told my mother that I thought something was wrong with Shiloh. I had noticed that Ruth talked differently to Shiloh when she did not know I was around. One day, I had gone over to Shiloh's bedroom through the oak tree and was about to go search for her in the house when I heard her mother speaking to her downstairs. Before I tiptoed back to the window and made my way back through the secret avenue that connected our houses, I heard Ruth's voice again. What she said made me stop to make sure I had heard it correctly.
"Close that door when you talk to me," Ruth shouted, "or we'll all be dead of pneumonia. That's what you want, for all of us to be dead. Go and wash your hands. Don't play in the dirt anymore. God didn't make you an ant. My God, those hands! Come here. Turn off that stove. Are you crazy or what? Do you want the fire department to get a raise?"
I didn't recognize the woman who was speaking, this off-center, nerve-damaged version of Ruth Fox. It was my first occluded view of the childhood Shiloh was living through, because the Germans had overrun and destroyed her parents' world. It would be much later that I would learn that the Nazis were frequent visitors to that house, that they sat with their blue-eyed stares through meals, belched at the lighting of the candles on every Sabbath eve, and that Shiloh grew up believing that germs were simply lowercase Germans who fed on the souls of Jews. As I passed through the thick branches of oak, I heard Ruth say,
"Get away from that window, Shiloh. The angel of death could be passing by."
I turned back and saw Shiloh's small, fearful face. She waved at me, and I waved back. I realize now that the Fox's house on the point in Waterford was simply an annex of Bergen-Belsen, a rest stop on the way to the crematoriums. Neither of Shiloh's parents could leave the country of their hideous past. George Fox played his music to console those who went up in smoke and joined the airstreams over Poland. Each black note celebrated the loss of a soul who entered the river of death without the consolation of music. The house floated with tears and terror and uncontainable fury, and music that made children dream of the jackbooted intruders who lit their way with torches made of Jewish hair. After we were married, Shiloh would tell me about her southern childhood. She thought that at any moment German soldiers could surround her house in a rapid flanking movement, in which every vine and red bud and azalea would perish. But these were offhand and unusual confessions for Shiloh. Mostly, she was silent to the point of obsession about her parents' war experiences. The subject became verbal.